funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
I have a special request today. For this next hour, set aside everything you know about addiction, that it's a progressive brain disease, or that it's a moral failing, even that it's an equal opportunity condition, and consider that conventional wisdom about people who get hooked on drugs or alcohol may be flat out wrong. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Many assumptions about the nature of addiction are influenced by the philosophy of 12-step programs, which have helped and continue to help many people gain control over their addictions, but nevertheless were developed in the absence of modern scientific knowledge about addicted brains. Today, some researchers say addiction has less in common with a brain disease like Alzheimer's than with a developmental difference like autism or ADHD. And that knowledge may suggest a wider range of treatments available to help people gain control over their drug and alcohol use. Journalist Maya Solovitz is a Soros Justice Fellow and a contributor to Time, Scientific American, and The New York Times. Her new book is called Unbroken Brain, a revolutionary new way of understanding addiction. Maya, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
At what point does drug use become drug addiction?
When compulsive behavior continues despite negative consequences. So if you are using and your life is going well and you're doing fine at work and you're doing fine with your kids and you're doing fine with your relationships, that's not addiction. It's when those things start to go wrong and when you continue despite things continuing to go wrong that addiction sets in.
Does the distinction between physiological and psychological dependence matter?
Well, everything has to come down to physics in the brain, unless you are considering the soul, which we will not be doing here right now. but I think that that distinction has done a great deal of harm. In fact, it harmed me personally because in the 1980s, when I started using cocaine, I was told that physical dependence was the really important thing. And cocaine really doesn't produce physical dependence. You may get awfully cranky and irritable and annoyed and be totally driven by craving if you don't get cocaine. But you won't be physically ill the way you are if you don't get heroin. And so before crack, people were arguing that coke is no more addictive than potato chips because it doesn't cause the physiological dependence that we see with opioids. And that is obviously not a good perspective. The other problem with that view is that you can be dependent on lots of things. We're all dependent on oxygen, for example. That doesn't mean we're oxygen addicts. And so it is not useful to just consider addiction as needing something to function because we all need many things to function. And that's not a problem as long as we can obtain those things and those things aren't harming us.
From a distance in your teens and early 20s, you would not have looked like a person at risk for addiction, and yet you were.
No, I mean, I was a straight-A student. I was involved in a million extracurricular activities. I was, I looked on the outside like I had friends, although I didn't actually believe that. I seemed reasonably happy, although I was sort of deeply troubled in certain ways. And so, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, our image of addiction is shaped by decades of racist propaganda, basically. And so we think that the image of addiction has to be somebody who's not us, somebody who is a minority or poor or, just looks different to us in some ways. And that is not, in the sense that's just not true about addiction. It can hit anybody, but there are certain things that really make you at higher risk. I like to say that it kicks people who are already down. So if you have depression or any other mental illness, if you've suffered childhood trauma, if you are suffering some kind of existential despair, if you are jobless, if you just feel hopeless, all of these things are going to increase your risk. So it's not the case that it's equal opportunity, but it's a different source of different kind of equal opportunity.
What does drug addiction have in common, Maya, with developmental disabilities or differences?
Well, for one, addiction almost always starts in the teens or 20s. So you get 90% of all addictions starting at that time. And that gives you a clue because that's an important time for brain development. at that point, your cortex is starting to finish itself, but it hasn't quite finished. And your reward systems are sort of revved up in order to get you out of the house and get you interacting with peers and get you away from your parents so that you can, you know, basically reproduce. So we have this system that is driving us to take risks and to do things that retrospectively seem completely awful at that time. You know, most of us, fortunately, are able to outgrow that. But a lot of psychiatric disorders, schizophrenia, for example, which is also a neurodevelopmental condition, start to come on at this time. And the brain basically unfolds over a certain course of development in response to environmental experiences. And so if you have some kind of different wiring, this can put you at risk. And I think that addiction essentially is a different form of wiring.
Does addiction fundamentally change the brain?
Yes, although it changes the brain not the way your sort of traditional disease changes the brain. It changes the brain the way falling in love or having a child changes the brain. And what I mean by that is if you think about how people behave when they fall in love or have a kid, their priorities tend to change completely. And they are directed by making sure those relationships stay okay and making sure they're doing what they think is the right thing to make sure that those relationships are sustained. So when it's a drug instead of a kid or a partner, this becomes deeply problematic because you begin to prioritize your drug as if your survival and your, you know, future of reproduction depended on it. And so it becomes a biological goal for you. But that doesn't mean your brain is damaged. It just means that you've fallen in love with the wrong thing, and that's not progressive.
Why is it so hard to stop once one realizes that, you know, dependence on a particular substance is causing real problems?
Well, what happens is you think that your life depends on having this substance. You believe that the most important goal in your life is to get that substance, and it's hard to distance yourself from the areas that are creating that kind of a motivation. So, I mean, I remember when I was shooting cocaine, I would completely know that it was going to be an awful experience, and yet I completely wanted it tremendously, and I couldn't stop myself from doing it. And so I knew something was wrong because, like, why would you want something desperately that you don't like? The only other instances in which that tends to happen is relationships. And so, but yeah, for many, many months, I would sit there and shoot up like up to 40 times a day, which is an insane amount. But I was living with a coke dealer and dealing myself, so I had access. And so I would just, you know, I just couldn't stop myself.
This is so interesting to me, and you write really beautifully and candidly about it, but it didn't feel good anymore, but you couldn't stop.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of our biggest misconceptions about addiction is that people with addiction are just having so much fun using drugs that we have to be really, really awful to them and cruel to them in order to make them want to stop. I think that view has done a tremendous amount of harm because it deters people with addiction from seeking help because they think the help is going to be harmful and awful. And too many times it is actually abusive. So, but yeah, we've had this idea that, you know, addiction is just like hedonism and pleasure seeking. And, you know, you are devoting your life to this stuff because it's so amazing. But by the time you're devoting your life to it, it is not amazing anymore.
What happened when you signed up for help at a methadone clinic?
Well, I went to what was an unfortunately unresearch-based program where the idea was we're going to detox you first over the course of 3 weeks, and when that didn't work for me, over the course of 6 months. And so basically what happened with me was that as soon as they started lowering the dose, I started raising my heroin dose, so it made the whole business completely useless. Plus, I was continuing to shoot cocaine on top of that. Now, that's a thing that I say, but I have to add a caveat, which is that the best treatment that we currently know of to reduce the death risk from opioid addiction is methadone or buprenorphine. Those two things taken indefinitely, not taken over 6 months and reduced, but taken potentially for life, reduce the death rate by 50 to 70%, and we don't have anything else that can do that, not 12 steps, not abstinence, not anything. So it's really important for parents and family members and loved ones of people with opioid addiction to pills or heroin or any of this to know that that treatment can keep your kid or your loved one alive long enough to enter recovery. And so, you know, we really shouldn't stigmatize that treatment. But unfortunately, when I came, when I got into abstinence-based recovery, I bought into all the myths about methadone. And I actually wrote an op-ed, which I now completely disagree with, saying that it was just like replacing vodka with gin.
But you don't feel any kind of intoxication, right, from methadone?
That's a really important point. Like, if I gave you methadone right now, you would get completely intoxicated. But and you might actually overdose on it. But I would have naloxone. But the thing is that tolerance to opioids is complete. It's not the case with alcohol. So if I did replace vodka with gin, I would still be impaired. But with opioids, if you take the same dose at the same time every day, you get a complete tolerance to the psychoactive effect. So you are not high. And a lot of people who find opioids maybe have a pre-existing difference in their endogenous opioid system. And so they need that extra dose to stay in a steady state that's comfortable for them. But that doesn't mean they're high. It's just like being on an antidepressant, basically.
So why all the moral outrage against these medications that might get people off the intoxicating drugs?
Well, I think we really don't understand tolerance. I think we think that they're high all the time. And the other reason that people think that is because most of the people who are on maintenance at any given time will be using on top. So maybe 50%, maybe 60%. And those people will be getting high. The thing is, they're still getting the death reducing, harm reducing effects of the medication, but they are not in recovery. The people who are in recovery, which will be about 40 to 50% at any given time, will be getting their lives back, will be working, will be doing all these other things. But because methadone is so stigmatized and because buprenorphine is so stigmatized, those people generally will not talk to the media. And also, if you go and hang around at a methadone clinic, the people who will be hanging around will be the people who are using on top, and the other people will be running in and out, and you won't even notice them because they have to get back to work.
Addiction is a serious problem for individuals and for society as a whole, but surprisingly, the vast majority of people who use addictive drugs do not become addicted. What's different about the people who develop a dependency?
There's several things, and they all sort of come down to some kind of extreme emotional pain. Oftentimes, it's a outlying temperament that is a predisposition for some sort of mental illness. So, for example, if you have a really extremely anxious child who may be on their way to developing an anxiety disorder later, this can put you at risk. But on the other end of the spectrum, you might have a really bold, impulsive, thrill-seeking child, and that can put them at risk too. The other huge risk factor for addiction is trauma. Two-thirds of people with addiction have suffered some sort of severe childhood trauma, and the more different types of trauma you experience, like abuse and neglect and losing family members and witnessing violence and every possible disaster that could happen, the more of that happens to you, the more likely you are to have a out-of-sync stress system and to find especially opioids to be really relieving.
We're speaking this hour with science writer Maya Salovitz. Her new book is called Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org. Find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Maya Solovitz. Her new book is called Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Maya, this book challenges so many myths, not least of which is that addictions last forever. You've learned through your research that age can be a powerful remedy.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising. And I think the reason it's surprising is because the people who have the worst addictions are the most visible. So if I were going to write a book about I aged out of addiction, it would be a really, really boring book because it'd be basically like, well, I used a lot of drugs and then I saw that it was a problem and I stopped.
Mm-hmm.
and so like that would not be a bestseller.
Right.
So and also the scientists have had a very sort of narrow focus in terms of addiction, because the people who show up in treatment are the people who haven't been able to stop on their own, who haven't outgrown it. And so we don't see these millions of people. I mean, half of all people with addiction no longer have addiction by age 30, which is an astonishing statistic, but it comes from large epidemiological surveys of tens of thousands of people conducted over 20 to 30 years. So it's like to see this repeated, it suggests that there's a real thing going on here.
So we often assume that people who quit on their own weren't really addicted. It sounds like that's not what you're saying. I think many people will know someone who voluntarily quit, say, drinking, and sometimes they're dismissed as not having had a problem.
Right. And that's why the epidemiology is so important, because basically what they do is they survey people in the community and they determine who meets diagnostic criteria for addiction under the DSM, whichever number it happens to be at the time. And so they find those people and then they re-interview them again. So some of those people who look indistinguishable from the people who can't quit turn out to have quit in the middle. So that's how you know, like if you only define addiction retrospectively, this is where you run into this problem.
Why is the cold turkey method, which is quitting all at once and never touching the problematic substance again, why is that the only one that gets treated like a serious option?
I don't know. I mean, there are many different reasons for that. But a lot of it is that we think that addiction is extra pleasure seeking. And so we want to get these people who cheated and got extra pleasure to have extra pain.
Hmm.
I mean, it really is a moral thing. We would never leave symptoms of any other condition except perhaps for pain untreated as a way of saying, you know, we think you're bad. But we do that with addiction all the time.
Yeah, and there's a real, I mean, from what I have read in much of the community that supports 12-step programs, there's a belief that if you have suffered from an addiction, cutting back will never be enough and will never lead to a healthier lifestyle.
Right. And again, the epidemiological data contradicts that. We see about as many people resolving drinking problems by cutting back as we do by stopping entirely. Now, that's not to say that there are not many people who absolutely need to be completely abstinent.
Right.
And it's not to say that if complete abstinence is working for you, you should go out and try moderation. That is not the point here. What is the point is that some people, usually on the less severe end of the spectrum, but not always, do succeed in moderation. And since many people won't seek help if they think it means complete abstinence, if we want to help more people, we actually have to offer the chance to try moderation. And in fact, AA's own, either the Big Book or the 12 and 12, I forget which one, says that if you are not convinced by our arguments, go out and try some controlled drinking. If you succeed, then you don't have to come back. And if you don't succeed, you will be absolutely convinced that you can't succeed. And that's really necessary for abstinence.
Traditionally, people have been advised that the route to recovery begins with like losing everyone and everything they ever cared about. You know, hitting rock bottom is the term people use. It turns out you're more likely to succeed in overcoming addiction if you still have a job and friends and family who care about you.
Absolutely. And the irony here is that we define addiction as compulsive behavior despite negative consequences. So if negative consequences were going to fix it, it would already have been fixed. So this argument drives me nuts. And this idea that you need to hit bottom is so harmful because it leads us to become very cruel towards people with addiction exactly when they need us the most.
Is there some evolutionary benefit to being the kind of person who persists in an activity despite negative consequences? I mean, you could argue that there's a lot of big goals in life. You know, climbing Mount Everest is painful and uncomfortable and, you know, leads many people to the brink of death, but they're proud after they do it. Is there any relationship between that and the temperament of someone who becomes addicted?
Absolutely. And this is why addiction is not only a disability, but can also be a real source of strength. I mean, I could never succeed as a writer if I couldn't persist despite negative consequences because I get rejected all the time. And so, you know, that quality, if it's directed towards the right thing, can be absolutely wonderful. The problem is when it's directed towards the wrong thing.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Katie on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Katie.
Hi there. I was wanting to ask Maya if she thought it might be a dangerous concept to introduce to recovering alcoholics or addicts, this idea of being able to age out of your addiction. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I have 6 years sober. And I know that one of the biggest things that we learn in AA is that your brain is going to tell you, you know, that you can drink again, you know, you've got it under control, blah, blah, blah. But in reality, if you start drinking again, it's going to be a downward spiral all over. So, I mean,
I think that if you have found something that works for you, you should stick with that. I mean, it's great that you have 6 years, and I admire people in recovery. I am a person in recovery. I think that, you know, the it is important to do what works for you. What's also important is not to impose what works for you on everybody because it might not be what works for them. So, but if you're in recovery and you have found through hard experience that you cannot control it, that is an important thing to know, and that means you will never be able to control it, and you should stay abstinent. You know, the point here is not to, like, send people in recovery on a giant relapse spree. The point is to get more people into recovery by making it more inclusive, by allowing people who have traditionally been seen as not ready or not able to get better in any way to start to get better. And so I think it's really important to recognize that different things work for different people. And if the 12-step program is working for you, go for it. If it's not working for you, that's when we want to be trying other things.
So what kinds of other things are there? You talk about one-on-one counseling as opposed to the 12-step program, which often involves kind of a group therapy setting.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think this is especially important for teenagers because with teenagers, we have no clue who's going to age out and who won't.
Mm-hmm.
And so obviously, if somebody's got to the point of shooting up, we can expect that they're unlikely to age out or not to do so quickly. But that's a different issue. Most teenagers, they'll be drinking and smoking pot, and we have no idea the level of the severity of the problem. And
that's terrifying.
So, I know. And I mean, it's, you know, but so the problem is if you take a teenage pot smoker and put them in a group with a bunch of heroin injectors, they might A, learn where to buy heroin, and B, think those people are cooler than them. So this is a real, it's basically like making your kid hang out with the kids that you are trying to get them not to hang out with. So this is where one-on-one counseling is really important because you eliminate that risk. And when you can find somebody that the teenager or person with addiction in general can relate to, that can lead to a lot of positive growth without the risks of group. Now, obviously, once you have somebody who's already seriously addicted, you don't have to worry so much about those risks. But the, you know, the, and also I should say there's many different types of counseling and some of which are more effective than others. For addiction, cognitive behavioral therapy for addiction is one evidence-based approach that can be done either individually or in groups. Something called motivational enhancement therapy is also really effective and, again, can be done in groups or individually. So I think one of the things that's really difficult about addictions is 80 to 90% of our treatment is completely not based on evidence. And it's really, really hard to find good care. And I find my heart breaking every time I get a phone call or an email from a parent who's facing this decision, because I wish I could say, here's where you go. And I can't. I can give them some questions to ask, but I can't. Unfortunately, the treatment business is so so much of a business and so much less of a helping organization that it is really off course.
How important is it that the motivation to quit comes from within? Can an intervention, whether it's, you know, one that starts with loved ones or starts with a court, can that push somebody toward recovery?
I think the best way to get people toward recovery is to attract them rather than to try to confront them or to create more consequences if they don't follow what you say, because oftentimes their brains aren't responding to consequences, which is the problem. So there is a method of getting people into recovery that does not involve confrontation or threats or any of these kinds of things, that is actually twice as effective as the confrontational, you know, have the big meeting and yell at the person approach. And this approach is called Community Reinforcement and Family Therapy. The acronym is CRAFT. And the idea is basically that you attract the person. You give them hope that they can recover. A lot of the reason people resist getting help is that they think that their life is going to be unbearable and unlivable without their substance. And you need to be able to offer them concrete hope that that is not the case, and that if they go somewhere that is harmful or abusive, you're on their side and you're going to help them find something better, and you're going to find something better until you find something that actually works. I think the other important thing for people who are considering seeking help or finding help for somebody is that you need a complete psychiatric evaluation at the start from somebody who is not affiliated with any program. Because unfortunately, if you show up at a program, you're going to get what they offer generally. Mm-hmm. And so if you have severe depression, you want to go somewhere that's going to be helping you with that. Particularly if you have Asperger's, you want to be going somewhere that knows how to deal with that. You know, if you have antisocial personality, just like all these things require very different approaches. And so it's a good idea to really try to get a sense of what's going on so that you can have a roadmap for what issues are likely to come up.
Is it going too far to say that addiction is often a symptom rather than the disease or disorder itself?
Yes, I think that is true. I mean, it becomes a disorder in itself over time. That's how you sort of learn addiction. Most of the time, people are medicating something. And if you don't figure out what it is that they're medicating and find healthier ways of dealing with that, the odds of recovery are really low.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372. We have Chris on the line in Houston. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Okay. My question is, under the new definition that I'm hearing about being an addict or an addiction, my situation is I've been taking pain pills for about 6 or 7 years now, and it is truly because of pain. You know, I have a pretty labor-intensive job. It's completely managed. You know, I'm not out on the street buying them. I have a prescription, and I take my prescription. But I do know if I don't take it, I'm in serious trouble, you know, withdrawals and such. Does this still classify me as an addict?
No, you are absolutely 100% not an addict. You are a person in pain who is having their pain adequately treated, and the drugs are working for you. You are the people who, unfortunately, remain invisible in our current attack on opioid prescribing. And I think it's absolutely awful that people like you should have to suffer because people like me exist. Hmm. If the drugs are working for you, that is not addiction. And it is, I think it is a travesty that we had the former FDA commissioner in the New York Times the other day saying that, you know, oh, we should ignore the pleas of people who say that the opioids work for them. Opioids are strong painkillers. They work for some people. They continue to work for lots of people over long periods of time. Otherwise, maintenance with methadone or Suboxone wouldn't work, and you'd have to constantly escalate the dose. So I would say, absolutely, you are not an addict. Do not identify yourself as such. And I hope that your doctor continues to prescribe and that you do not run into any trouble based on, unfortunately, the current crackdown.
At the nadir of your addiction, Maya, you weighed 80 pounds, your hair was falling out, you know, things were really bad for you, you were kind of living in squalor. Can you identify with that sense of feeling like your life would be unlivable without heroin and cocaine? Because it seems like it would have been so obvious even to you that this was the source of your problems.
Well, no, and I mean, this is why addiction looks so different from the outside than from the inside.
Yeah.
I was just, you know, and it took me a long time to figure out what was going on. But for years and years and years before I became addicted, I had developed a weird set of very self-hating beliefs. And I was basically a very, very geeky kid who had a lot of different obsessions and who probably would have been labeled Asperger's if I had been growing up during the time when that diagnosis actually existed, but on the autism spectrum. And so I was socially clueless and desperately lonely, and I couldn't connect to people. And when I did connect to people, I couldn't really believe that they were my friends, because I thought if they really knew me, they would think I was horrible.
Mm.
And so, like, because I was so different as a kid, I just thought, like, I'm selfish and evil because I'm more interested in ideas than people. I didn't realize I was, like, wired differently. And so I developed a lot of hate, a lot of self-hate that developed into depression. And, you know, coke and heroin really worked for that, at least at first.
Yeah.
And the drugs also, for me, provided a really important bridge into social life. And I think this is, like, such a sad thing. But for kids, oftentimes, you know, the drug users are the only ones who will accept the weird kids.
My guest is science writer Maya Solovitz. Her new book is called Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Maya Solovitz, whose new book is called Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Maya, I think people listening want to be empathetic and understanding and offer support where they can. It is true that people with addiction can cause some serious problems, not only for themselves, but for the people in their lives. So where does harm reduction come into all this when the people living with or around someone with a serious addiction can't tolerate that anymore?
Well, and I mean, I think it's really hard on family members, and it's really important for family members and loved ones to take care of themselves first. You know, like they say, put your oxygen mask on first. I think that often gets neglected. And I also think that if somebody with addiction is stealing from you, is behaving terribly towards you, is a risk towards your other children, or you just can't take it anymore, those are all absolutely valid reasons to not have that person in your life. The thing that I think is problematic is cutting somebody out of your life in order to fix them, in order to try to make them get better, because that can actually make them get worse. And you just don't know what's going to happen. So for family members, it's a really difficult balancing act. And I am certainly not suggesting that you allow somebody to walk all over you or to treat you badly. It's a matter of what you can do, what you're willing to do, and what will actually help.
Is somebody with an addiction to one substance vastly more likely to be addicted to any other substance?
Yes, about 50% of people with addiction have more than one addiction. But that means that the other 50% do not. So it is quite possible for somebody who has a drug of choice, you know, like cocaine or heroin, to safely use another substance like alcohol or marijuana. Obviously, I am not recommending that anybody who is completely abstinent go out and do that. It's just that I know many people who have successfully done that, whether it is advisable or not.
Do you mind if I ask if you've just decided to stay away from everything that is potentially addictive?
I have mostly decided to do that. I don't like to talk about this specifically because, unfortunately, sometimes people who are completely abstinent will completely dismiss anything you say if you say that you ever use anything else. Mm-hmm. But I have drank, and it did not cause a disaster.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Carrie in Rockwall. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Maya, I just love what you're saying. I am a chemical dependency counselor here in Rockwall, and we have a medical stabilization program. They come in the hospital 3 days. We get them through the worst of their withdrawals. And one of the things that I always am telling my patients is, what road to recovery do you see for yourself? What does it look like? And I have had patients that have limited their use or reduced their use and have been quite successful at it. It's nice to hear somebody talking a different route to success of recovery besides abstinence. And I will back what you say. If you are being abstinent right now and it's working for you, certainly do not go out and start drinking or using. But if you have reduced use and it's working for you, I think you should be just as proud as that, of that.
Absolutely. And I think the it's really important for people to realize that because there are many, many different pathways into addiction, there are just as many different pathways out of addiction. And because addiction often revolves around deep existential questions, there's going to have to be very different solutions for different people, because somebody who is, you know, jobless may need something completely different than somebody who is profoundly depressed.
I want to talk for a minute about the narratives that we heard in the 1980s. They were often racially charged, and they have in some ways been discredited. But there was all this reporting on the so-called crack babies, right, that they were born addicts. And the assumption was the moment they were old enough to get their hands on a substance, they would be hopelessly addicted to it. What do we know about the truth of those individuals?
Well, that absolutely didn't happen. And they were also supposed to be completely disabled at the same time as they were supposed to be horrible, rampaging criminals, which didn't seem possible. But that was the racist stereotype. And no, the crack babies, which is a term we really shouldn't use, those drug exposed children grew up for the most part just fine. And what made the difference? What made the difference was what happened to them outside the womb, whether they were loved and nurtured and supported, and whether they had opportunities. You know, there was this whole idea that that group was supposed to be super predators, and, you know, crime fell. So, I mean, I think it's still kind of astonishing to me to see the difference in response that we're having now with the opioid epidemic, because the perception is this is a white problem. All of a sudden, we're open to harm reduction, whereas when in the 80s, when a lot of us were trying to get harm reduction done for needle exchange to prevent HIV, we were just told over and over that we were enabling people, that we were going to make people use more, that we weren't going to prevent HIV anyway. And, you know, the data overwhelmingly shows now that needle exchange and other harm reduction approaches, like providing the overdose reversal drug naloxone, do not encourage additional drug use, but they do keep people alive. And where there is life, there is hope.
So there are people who think needle exchanges don't work because people with an addiction are too much out of their heads to even give consideration to the possibility that they can either potentially get a disease from intravenous drug use, or they could protect themselves. What you're saying is that there's evidence that people are aware that they can be safer if they have clean needles.
Well, I can tell you from personal experience that that is why I do not have HIV or hepatitis C. When I started injecting, I was sharing, and I did get hepatitis A, bizarrely enough. Somebody from San Francisco happened to be visiting a friend of mine and taught me how to clean my needles. And ever since that point, I was compulsive about using them and I was compulsive about cleaning them. And, you know, I really believe that she saved my life. And I became, really compelled to get the information about needle exchange out there, because if she had just told me at that time, oh, don't share ever and don't just stop using, that was not going to happen at that point. I didn't have the tools to do that at that point. And so, it's really, we now know, New York State calls needle exchange the gold standard of HIV prevention. It is actually easier to get people with addiction to use clean needles than it is to get men to use condoms.
Hmm. Back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Matthew in Richardson. Hi, Matthew.
Hi. So I wanted to comment after listening to your guest talk about sort of her, autism symptoms and how that influenced her addiction, and my own experience with addiction and how it played with my mental health conditions and the importance of recognizing comorbid disorders that may exist and exacerbate addiction. Like in my own case, I'm pretty severely bipolar and have pretty severe ADHD. And in college, I started doing a lot of Vicodin and drinking and smoking a lot of pot, which helped seem to keep that under control until I started to get depressed. And then I would ramp up into mania. And this whole thing basically cost me in the entirety of 2006.
Hmm. I mean, I think it is, it can't be said enough how important comorbidity is. I mean, it is rare to find somebody who just happily going along the street one day at age 18 finds a drug and gives up their entire life for it. The vast majority of people with addiction that I've ever spoken with have had serious issues that they can trace back quite a long way usually. And bipolar is a big risk. ADHD is a big risk. Depression is a big risk. Anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, pretty much any mental illness or personality disorder will increase your risk for addiction, basically because it will make you unhappy and you will be searching for some way to feel comfortable in your own skin.
So that may be comforting to people whose loved ones don't suffer from any of those common problems. It might be terrifying to somebody sending, a kid away to school or worried about someone that they care about who does have these things. What can we do for the young people that we know are at risk because they might have one of these mental health issues or conditions?
Well, the first thing is make sure that those conditions are treated as well as possible with the best possible treatment for that person. The other thing is there's a really interesting prevention program that works with junior high or early high school kids. And the idea is to get these tendencies before they become things like depression. So if you have a kid with a sort of, depressive temperament, to stop that before they've hated themselves for 20 years and then you have to use Prozac. Hmm. So you teach them cognitive things that you would learn in cognitive therapy for depression, but before you get depressed and before you start self-medicating with drugs. And this program has four or five at least different studies that suggest that it helps. They also have one that's targeted for impulsive kids. What you really want is people to have coping skills to deal with whatever particular issues that they have. And you also want people to know that, if you try a drug, and we don't want you to do that, but if you happen to try a drug and it's the best thing ever, that's when you stop. And huh. What's interesting is there are many, many people who have told me, oh, I tried heroin once, or oh, I tried crack once. It was the best thing ever, and so I knew I should never do it again. those are called normal people. They are people who do not tell stories of addiction because they would be boring because they only tried it once. And so, you know, but those are also people who are not in emotional pain, who have something to live for, who have a life that is alternative to this. And so, you know, addiction is often about, you know, the contrast between, you know, having a life and not having a life.
It's been more than 20 years since you got clean. Do waves of craving ever present themselves in your life?
It's been a really, really long time. I was thinking about that the other day. My first 5 to 7 years, I had a lot of craving. And I, during that time, I didn't even take an antidepressant. I wouldn't take anything. I was very, very, very strict. And then I got really depressed, and I found that Prozac actually relieved a lot of the oversensitivity and sensory issues that I have, and also sort of shut up that voice that was filled with self-hate and allowed me to sort of be more present for other people. So after that time, I have not really had that many cravings. I mean, occasionally, you know, like I might pass a place where I had used to use and think, oh, wow. But it's really interesting. Like, I don't, like, I mean, I used to remember, like, they would be, like, as vivid as, like, a sexual fantasy or something. And they would, you know, they would really take over my mind. But it, you know, I mean, and I think about it, you know, like, it's like I was only addicted for about 3 or 4 years. And I am now, you know, more than 20 years past that. So you know, after a while, I started thinking, like, it's kind of weird to identify my whole identity with that one short period of my life. But I knew that that one short period of my life grew out of the very formative early experience. So I do still sort of see it as part of my identity. I do not think I could safely use cocaine or heroin, and I am not intending to try that.
Good.
Although I do reserve the right when I'm 90 something and I'm in pain.
Yeah. Yeah. Why do you think we're ready at this moment in our history to consider that maybe 12-step programs don't work for everyone or are not the solution for everyone, and there may be alternatives that do work for people? Because I think even 15 years ago, this would have been anathema.
Oh, no. And I mean, believe me, I've been saying this for a long time. And really, you know, in the 90s, it was impossible to get this message out there. I think the important thing is that 12 steps are a fabulous self-help group. 12 steps are not medicine. You know, there's nowhere else in medicine where you are told to find a higher power and surrender to them. If you were told that by your oncologist, you would fire your oncologist. Your oncologist is not your cancer support group. In your cancer support group, it is perfectly appropriate and perhaps life-saving to have spirituality for many people. So I just think that what we need to do is, in professional treatment, it should not be 12-step, because you can get that for free elsewhere and it doesn't work for everybody. People should know that that's an option, but it should be seen as peer support, not as treatment. And treatment should be getting the mental illness and other coexisting issues dealt with, and for these very organized cognitive techniques that you can learn in a systematic way.
The new book by journalist Maya Solovitz is called Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. Maya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.